Welcome to the second episode of the season on the Beverage Report podcast. In this episode, we interview Professor K.U. Jin and discuss a wide range of topics, including international trade, the Chinese economy, international finance, and her new book, The New China Playbook. Special thanks to Urvi and Dave for this episode, and the wider Beverage Report podcast team, as well as the Department of Economics at LSE. Let me begin by introducing our guest today, Professor K.U. Jin. Dr. Jin is a tenured professor of economics at LSE and a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader, with her research focusing primarily on international macroeconomics. She has a wide range of experience working in international organizations like IMF, World Bank, and the China Banking Regulatory Commission, as well as various financial institutions. She is the author of the critically acclaimed book, The New China Playbook. Dr. Jin holds a BA, MA, and PhD in economics from Harvard University. Hello, Professor Jin. I hope you're doing well.
Great. It's great to be with you.
Perfect. So to begin with, we would love to hear about your first encounter with economics and how it shaped your liking for the subject.
I guess we thought about economics a lot just by, you know, reading The Economist when I was a high school student, and just, you know, I was in New York, I suppose, and people's parents were in finance, so that's the first encounter. And then, you know, my family was also part of China's issuing government bonds in the early days, in the late 1990s, and I kind of see that in action. And I thought, geez, wouldn't it be wonderful to understand some of the deeper aspects of, you know, investment banking, about economics, about macro, that for a long period of time during China in those years were so critical. And so that's the first encounter. And I guess the deeper encounter was my micro course at Harvard as a college student. And it went in a huge amount of depth, and this is really interesting, using models to understand economic phenomenon, and that's where all the interest started, I guess.
Right, that's lovely to hear. So let's delve into your book, The New China Playbook, so where you seek to break down the West's misconceptions about China's rise. So firstly, what do you think are the biggest misconceptions that the West has about China, and why is it important that these myths are dispelled?
There are a lot of misconceptions, but I'd say the most important one is misunderstanding China's model, how it has fostered a unique balance between industry and markets, coordination and market mechanisms, individualism and communalism that has allowed China to have this really spectacular growth in the last 40 years. The second big misunderstanding is about the Chinese people, which is also the basis of an economy. So understanding the cultural, historical aspects of the country and its people is very important to fill that big gap. And it's important to understand these things or demystify such important aspects of the second largest economy in the world, especially today, because I think it's become very dangerous, highly dangerous, between the two largest economies to not see eye to eye on many things, and in particular to not see each other's perspective, because the lack of not only effective communication, but at a very deep level, the lack of understanding of each other's system, values, and what their people really want and desire.
Right. So following up on that, you argue that China's growth miracle can be attributed to this unique combination of political centralization and economic decentralization. So could you perhaps explain this further for our audience and tie it with what you call a mayor economy?
Well, first of all, people just think of, you know, economists tend to think that if you give a country free markets, things should just work well, and they attribute China's economic success to the rival markets and a market economy. I think that's a gross simplification of China's success. Markets exist everywhere around the world. Lots of developing countries' economies were based on the notion of free markets, and yet why hasn't it achieved what China has achieved? And I think the concept of having a certain amount of state role, a role of the state, but in a very, you know, particular way, not in the central planning way that we used to think about planned economies or too much interventions in terms of industrial policies, but really a systematic way where the state can allocate, coordinate, and mobilize. Sometimes warlike mobilization is really important to jumpstart a country's development path, to leap on that path, and that's what China did. Now, most of us think about China as having an extremely centralized approach, but the more accurate description is political centralization coupled with really an extreme form of economic decentralization. And neither of that can be missing in the equation to produce these effects, because political centralization plays a critical role of not only setting the nation's strategic objective, and you need some coordination on the top for that, but it can monitor local implementation, right, and the decentralized model, because it holds the keys to the promotion of local officials who are in charge of making the economy flourish and successful. That's a critical element. Actually, the Soviet Union didn't have as much political centralization, that therefore their economic decentralization didn't work as well. There was a lot of expropriation going on, and there was a lot of corruption. But economic decentralization in China was hugely important because, first of all, in 1978, when the reforms started, it was the local officials that started to implement these reforms. And these reforms started from breaking rules in a highly dogmatic country steeped in, you know, Cultural Revolution, the tail end of the Cultural Revolution and mentality. Who broke through these rigidities with local officials? And they were very enterprising, they were risk takers, they were highly innovative, and they had appetite to do these dramatic things for the economy because they were incentivized by the central government, who promoted them based on the success of their economic programs. And even fast forward today, the assessment of local officials is on a broader metric than GDP growth for the last 40 years, 30 years or so at least. GDP growth was the basic metric to assess government officials' success and basing the promotion on that. But now it includes a broader metric of environmental protection and especially innovation technology. So now if you look at China today, the technology unicorns or unicorn companies are spread all over China, not just focused on in one Silicon Valley type of place, but everywhere. And why? Because these local officials are all pushing in the way they can to attract the best companies, to keep them there, or to create mini Silicon Valleys, including helping them coordinate supply chains. If you just look at emerging technologies like EVs, 300 competing EV companies all spread over China with a local government behind them is just a model that really only truly exists in China. But you needed critically both a very strong central government and at the same time enough autonomy passed down to the local levels to do these very creative, innovative, enterprising, and risk-taking things.
Right. So, sort of piggybacking on that, in the past decade, China has increasingly been active in exporting capital to developing countries. So while replication is not feasible, what do you think are the key takeaways for fellow developing countries?
I think the model can't be easily replicated, nor might it be desirable to replicate it. But I think there are important elements from China's developmental success that could be useful for other developing countries. For China, manufacturing exports played a very important role, and a certain amount of state coordination to jumpstart industrialization was also very important. It was part of that process. Infrastructure, again, very important. But of course, you know, you can't just build infrastructure in a place without a local thriving economy. Mm-hmm. And that might be part of the problem of China's infrastructure programs around the world, is that, yes, they can bring expertise and even financing to build infrastructure, but a lot of locals might ask, but who brings us the food, right? Mm-hmm. So it's an enabling process. Infrastructure has been critically important because productivity ultimately is a network, and infrastructure builds is providing that network. It's a network in and of itself. So infrastructure was really important. Huge amount of domestic saving was important, because if you rely on foreign saving, that creates a huge amount of uncertainty and potential financial chaos, which China was able to successfully avoid as a domestic, developing country. I'd say fourth, it's fine to be a growing economy, an immature economy with very immature institutions, which China had in the earlier days. And this is where the government can play a role, right? It's not any state intervention, and it's not even just the size of a state, but the quality of state capacity and what they can do. So a lot of these state involvement were there precisely because institutions were immature. And they had a lot of power precisely because of that as well. But how to use that power could differ, you know, widely across countries, and that's where kind of the variance comes from, is do you use these powers to expropriate, in which case you've killed the goose that lays the golden eggs, or do you use these powers to multiplicatively, exponentially grow the economy and nurture thousands and thousands and millions of productive private companies? And how you do that, even without the best rule of law, you know, China ranked the bottom half in terms of rule of law, business environment, corruption index, and so forth, and didn't stop growing. It didn't stop 20 million private companies from emerging from nowhere, even though in 1978, nobody spoke about capitalism. So how you use these state powers is also really important. And I think lastly, macro and financial and political stability, absolutely essential. I think this comes first before anything else. Mm-hmm.
So as our listeners may know, China has two official currencies, the domestic renminbi and the offshore yuan. With China's increasing integration into the global economy, do you foresee yuan as an international currency?
Certainly, that is part of the very important internationalization agenda for the government, right? The government leadership certainly likes to see the RMB being internationally used, becoming reserve currency. And it has worked towards that effect. Trade invoicing denominated in RMB grew from basically nil to 25% of trade invoicing, at least with China, trade with China denominated in RMB. And certainly that has a push on the RMB, but ultimately the level of internationalization and the usage and the prevalence of it depends on the facility of having access to RMB assets and of, you know, being able to, you know, the convertibility. But ultimately, it also depends on the financial system as a whole, you know, the breadth, the depth and liquidity of something like the U.S. financial system, the massive treasuries and bond markets, affords the U.S. dollar a very prominent role, also not only used in trade, but also in banking and for lending and borrowing purposes. Now, does China have a very deep financial system? Not yet, although that could change over time, but I think it will take a very long time. Certainly it doesn't have certainly with capital controls, it is a problem, but as you mentioned, there's an offshore currency, which is a parallel currency, and it is freely traded and convertible, and that seems to have multiplied quite successfully, and a lot of developing countries are using the offshore currency RMB holding it and to use it as exchange. So I think it satisfies two out of the three roles of an international currency, with the exception of, you know, really having access to RMB assets, right? What do you do with these RMB, offshore RMB? You can't really hold it, because what are you going to hold it in, right? The assets are not available. But apart from that, I think the facility to use it is actually quite high. And so I think it's not inconceivable that there are some exterior shocks like geopolitical or, you know, developing countries being increasingly disgruntled with the U.S.'s weaponization of the dollar to move towards an alternative currency, that the RMB will become more popular in usage. For sure, not to U.S. levels, but a potential sizable increase, I think, is absolutely plausible and likely.
Right. So now looking into your research on international trade and the Chinese economy. So the younger generation in China, in your words, is significantly different from the previous generations. Could you give us more of a defining characteristic of this generation and how it impacts China's economic development?
The new generation is radically different from the previous generations, and they represent the biggest generational gap that China has seen, I think, in history. Precisely because the parents' generation was born in a very poor and turbulent China. Some have gone through the Cultural Revolution, Great Famine, and have seen China's vicissitudes, and they have had both physical and psychological hardship. Pretty much everyone that has gone through those decades of chaos. Think about the new generation born in relative privilege and prosperity. One child being the only child, so being the focal point of every family, so invariably more confident, more relaxed in some sense, less driven by, you know, no option and no choice and a fit for survival, fight for survival kind of mentality compared to their parents. And so that these have really important social and economic consequences. On the economic side, the desire to save for a rainy day, precautionary saving, these aspects are a lot weaker. They are very happy to borrow. If you look at university students today, you know, no income, and they click on one click on Taobao and Alibaba, gets you a lipstick funded based on borrowing, based on no income. I don't know who settles these accounts, maybe their parents. So again, this intergenerational dynamism and altruism, kind of unique in the world, at least in the Chinese culture, is also an important aspect, important reason to explain why they can afford to purchase such, you know, high property prices, right? Property with such exorbitant prices, because they have six wallets. Every one child has six wallets together with their spouse. So these cultural idiosyncrasies can explain some of these quixotic economic phenomenon. But also in terms of lifestyle, you know, they have a very different view of what life should be about and how to go about with their career and their life. And they focus a lot on lifestyle spending. I think some of the data show that, well, first of all, 85% of consumer credit is taken by people under 35. And despite having less income, because they're still younger than the previous generations, they spend twice as much on apparel, things like travel and food. So they're very interested in turning their local environment into, you know, a place filled with great restaurants and coffee places. And maybe they're not even that hungry to earn a really high income, but the balance has firmly shifted from pure work, like the Foxconn workers who opted for three shifts a night in the early 90s and 2000s, to a much heavier weight on leisure, right? And so apart from these economic aspects, I think they're also a very different generation that is probably a point of convergence with the rest of the world, in the sense that they're more open-minded, they care about diversity issues, they care about animal rights and social issues and environment, and they're very passionate about these things. And that's precisely afforded by a greater material, you know, life provided by their parents. And that's what happens to a country on that trajectory from a young economy to a richer economy. And the world has to be patient with young economies, because a lot of these international controversies, including Chinese people being so hardworking to the point of having ousted a lot of jobs elsewhere, comes from that young economy hunger drive, which the new generation in China obviously has less of. So it's a cycle of renewal to another place, and that's how we should see it, rather than seeing it as a permanent state, seeing the Chinese people as having a permanent set of values and working spirit, but rather as just an economic cycle and a social cycle.
Right. So that ties nicely with my next question. So in your recent paper, you conclude that China's one-child policy accounts for at least a third of the rise in aggregate household savings since the 1980s. Do you think this generation would be welcoming of more policy regulations, given that they are facing issues like education skill mismatch and employment gap due to the one-child policy?
First of all, I'm not sure some of the problems that they're facing as potential parents, young parents, have necessarily to do with one-child policy. I think one aspect does have to do with that, which is education and the rising cost of education. And in my paper, we call this the quantity-quality trade-off. So if you can't have many children, why not raise their quality so everybody goes and over-educates them, if you will, and that creates a competition, a tournament that makes that drives up the cost. And a lot of these education companies were not shy of exploiting these parents' vulnerabilities and susceptibility. So I think that has a lot to do with a one-child policy, but rising housing prices, less so. And that's also one of the determinants for how many children you want to have, because they see the rising cost of rearing children, whether it's education or the fact that having space is so expensive in urban areas. And maybe because they have gone through a highly competitive childhood, filled with exam taking and tutorials and extracurriculars to the point of slightly nonsensical competition, there's a little bit of disillusionment there. Maybe they don't want their children to go through these kind of very taxing environment and childhood experience. And so this is why a lot of those who have resources will send the kids abroad. Not necessarily because there's a better education system, but because it will be less, you know, less of a burden on the kids. I think all of these aspects have a lot to do with why potential young parents are not choosing to have many kids. And of course, the recent aspect of high youth unemployment has added to the fact that, okay, well, you can spend all the family fortune on investing in a child's education, but this child goes to college and does not even have a job, a first job. And so that has, you know, important implications on expectations of parents and families. I think all of that grim, kind of that grim picture that's painted to them is one important reason why they're not choosing to have lots of kids. And maybe I think there's one last side consequence of the one-child policy, which is that when you're used to having actually no siblings, you probably are not used to having big families and therefore choose to have three or four children. So I think all these things play a role, but it is an important social phenomenon in China to consider.
Right. So now looking into your research in international finance and macroeconomics, so in a recent paper, you argue that domestic reforms for reducing policy distortions are important for reaping gains from trade. Could you give our audience an example of this for developing countries in South or Southeast Asia?
Yes, everyone talks about opening up trade as if that's the panacea to, you know, economic woes and that it would open up doors. And I think partly that is true, but one of the things that reduces these gains or potentially prevents a country from fully reaping these gains is domestic distortions, as we show in this paper. Somewhat, let's say, not a new insight, but an insight that has been quantified with modern tools of economics. And just an example, if you look at China, there are lots of subsidies, right? Especially subsidies that happened during the 90s and early 2000s. And if a company, you know, in the canonical frameworks of economics, a company, a firm, can export because it's productive. Mm-hmm. It's because it's more productive than other companies. And that's why when you open up to trade and let these firms become bigger, you actually raise the average level of productivity for the entire economy, because these are the more productive companies that I can actually survive in foreign markets. Now, imagine that you have a very distorted economy where the biggest firms and those who can export are not necessarily those who are the most productive, but the most subsidized, right? And that is very plausibly the case in China. Then these subsidized firms expand and they export, but they're not the most productive. So you can actually make the more subsidies, the cost to the nation, higher, and aggregate levels of productivity could actually be lower, not higher, because these are not the productive companies. So that's a very easy example of why when you open up to trade, you can benefit some kind of firms, maybe even the politically connected or the subsidized or some other firms that are not the most productive in developing countries, then the welfare gains to trade are a lot smaller, and you can actually even squeeze out the resources from the more productive and potentially smaller firms. Now, in advanced economies in the data, it doesn't seem to be like that because it's productive firms that export, right? So that's a correlation. If you let them expand, then it brings raises aggregate welfare. So I think we try to make a point which we believe is important, which is you need to fix the economy domestically at the same time you open it up to trade, rather than just relying on trade to push for domestic reforms.
Right, makes sense. So in another paper with Professor Ilzetsky, you mention a dramatic shift in the international transmission of U.S. monetary shocks compared to other financial shocks. So what insights can you share from the recent Silicon Valley Bank collapse as compared to, let's say, the Great Financial Crisis?
Well, first of all, I think what is new about these banking crises and runs is, first of all, and this doesn't necessarily have to do with my work, but an observation, which is liquidity, banks' liquidity rather than solvency, is potentially an important determinant on whether the bank survives or not, survives runs or not. And another observation is that social media has played a very new role in potentially triggering bank runs for banks in fragile situations, but potentially could have survived without the social media news, fake news, that allows a huge number of retail investors to coordinate around some news that could be true or false. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, bank runs are so easy these days with depositors, electronically withdrawing, rather than the past when they have to line up in front of a bank, that kind of picture is very different. So that's my casual observation, having been involved with an investment bank. These are some interesting new observations. I guess our paper on the changing global implication of U.S. monetary policy, or the transmission of the U.S. fiscal monetary policy, has a lot to do with some important changes in the global financial architecture, which is the rise of global financial banks, the fact that, global credit cycles have a very important impact on the local economies through, potential bank balance sheets, rather than through just a simple exchange rate change that can impact the trade. So the financial channel has become more important, and that can change some aspects of how U.S. monetary policy is transmitted around the world. And so I guess our point is we want to think about both the trade channel and the financial channel together and look at some aspects that could mean very different things for global credit expansion, booms and busts, and how U.S. monetary policy works. And we have a very simple theory about that, but really the emphasis on and empirically how that has changed, where U.S. expansionary monetary policy doesn't necessarily lead to a depreciation of the dollar, which means an appreciation of the local currency, but actually the opposite. And that's kind of the puzzle that we pose, but we try to answer that with this global new environment of global banking.
Right. Thank you so much, Professor Jin. And finally, one last question that we ask all our economists on our podcast. What gives you hope?
Well, to be honest, it's pretty grim these days how people are really turning against each other. Countries are turning against each other. Lots of wasted resources on quibbles and vacuous conflicts. I'm not trying to suggest that that's true for all the conflicts we're seeing, but certainly for a lot of the power competition, I think so much of that resources can be harnessed to do great for the world, especially when we're thinking that 90% of the people still live in developing world and they really rely on a functioning global supply chain and global capital. And that we shouldn't forget that globalization actually has led to a dramatic fall in inequality across countries, even if inequality has risen within countries. And so the sad part is that some of this is being, hijacked by politicians with self-interest and motivations and party politics at the expense of, more ordinary people. So what gives me hope is not particularly hopeful, which is I think we do see this in cycles, right? And the realization that kind of hijacking by politicians and interested parties do become exposed at a certain point in time, and there's a return to pragmatism. And it's kind of cyclical, A few good decades of good years and globalization, everybody doing better, leads to not everybody doing better, of course, the divisions and the social or the inequalities within country, I don't think has a lot to do with globalization as it has to do with governments ineffectively helping their citizens adapt to an environment of new technology and globalization. And politicians using that to cause that kind of divisions and turning people against each other. But we do see a return to pragmatism after a certain period of time where, the good economic policies are really what matters in the end. That's a dim hope, if you will. But I'd say that, finally, the new generation gives me hope around the world. They do stand at a slightly higher moral pedestal. Their concerns are broader than themselves. And I think because of the internet age, because of the connections around the world, internet connections and digital connections and so forth, that notion of the laws of the jungle, the rules of the jungle, being so dominant in some of our leaders today and in the past, is substantially weakened, and that gives me hope.
Right. Thank you so much, and hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
To our discussion with Professor Jin. To know more about the New China Playbook, please find a link of the book in the description. If you found this episode interesting, please tune into our other episodes on Spotify or YouTube. For suggestions or requests, please reach out over email to a.kaur8@lse.ac.uk. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.